Ian.
Yeah.
So you know how chip companies will do like festive like special edition chips?
I don't ever want to talk about chips again. This was such a huge mistake.
Hear me out. Hear me out. Flamin' Hot Chipotle Ranch Cheetos.
What's the?
They're good. That's all I'm saying. They're really good.
I was like ready for the fight. I was like, what are you coming at me with here? Sorry, everyone I know has been texting me like really aggressive arguments about literally right now as we started recording. A text from Greg popped up on my computer, pointing out that I should say that pretzels are chips because they're pieces of bread and they're chips of bread according to my definition. He's like coming at me. So
Laura doesn't even listen to our podcast, but I conveyed the argument to her right after we finished recording, and she's like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And then we were walking through the store, and I realized, just like out of nowhere, I pointed to a bag of Fritos and was like, look, it's a bunch of chips of a tortilla, because it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life.
I hate you so much.
You're wrong with Ian and Bobby. You're wrong.
What's up, buddy?
Not much.
What have you been up
to? So, a couple of years ago, I had like I'm really susceptible to like marketing gimmicks.
Yeah, no kidding.
And collectible shit.
Bobby has had a real, real problem during our friendship with a couple. I would say Amiibos are a big one. And then,
Is Disney Infinity, which I easily sunk several hundred dollars into.
Yes,
Disney Infinity.
You were obsessed with those.
And so I was at, I went to, for the first time in a decade, a Toys R Us two weeks ago.
Okay.
Because I was looking for new cards for Drop Mix, because again, I'm susceptible to collectibles, and I talked a little bit about Drop Mix.
Yes.
So Disney Infinity got canceled.
I remember you basically texted me crying about it when it happened.
So Toys R Us is liquidating their stock of Disney Infinity figures. And so in looking for Drop Mix toys, I found a wall mostly empty of Disney Infinity figures going for $1.
I mean, don't you already have them all?
And the starter kit, which cost like $80 in its heyday, cost $1.98 at Toys R Us.
Wait, but so, you have that already too, right?
I did, yeah. So I didn't buy that, but I did walk away with Korra from Tron, Spot from The Good Dinosaur, and also Poe Dameron and Yoda. So it was pretty good.
So when are we starting the podcast, Bobby?
Oh, man. I hate myself.
I kind of hate you, too. No, that's pretty amazing. I could see, if that was something I cared about, being very excited about that.
No, I wasn't even excited. It was just resignation. Like, well, never going to buy these. What am I going to do? Am I gonna like, blow the dust off of my Wii
U
and, like play them again?
Do you have, like, a glass menagerie, like, case that you just display these all in? Like, what do you do with them?
I have, like, a toy box that is buried under a bunch of stuff
so
that
for
I dug.
For people who don't know, Disney Infinity is a game. It's a video game, but you buy, like, these actual, like, figures.
Mm-hmm. It's basically a physical DLC, you know? Like, it's downloadable content that you have to, like, buy a toy.
Yeah, which is everybody's favorite. Everybody loves the DLC model, especially when it's already built into the base game.
Yeah. You know, I don't regret it. It brought me a lot of joy, and now it's just something that takes up a lot of space.
Yes. Well, not much. I've been playing a lot of Xenoblade Chronicles. I really like that game.
It looks good. I've heard only good things about this game, and I really want to play it, but I've been like wasting my entire life on Zelda right now, which I'm not gonna get into a lot because I feel like we've already talked enough Zelda forever on this podcast.
I would say Bobby has sent me like 4 texts about Zelda a day for the last 2 weeks, And everyone else I've talked to, I'm like, did you know you could do this or this? And everyone is like, no. And they're like, how do you know that? I'm like, Bobby is obsessed with it. And he's literally found like every little tiny Easter egg in the entire game, which is
a million Easter eggs I still haven't found.
Yeah.
But that's basically what I did. I dropped the main quest and was just like, I'm going to start exploring. But I do want to say, so I found this, I looked up online what's the easiest way to get a bunch of rubies, and I found out there's a bowling game where Link goes to this old man's cabin, and he has like very enthusiastically set up a bowling alley in the snow, and you grab a giant snowball and throw it down a mountain and try to hit as many pins as you can.
Do you do it like Wii bowling?
No.
That's
no,
stupid.
No. And there's a lot of bumps on the hill that'll redirect your ball. And there's a very specific way you could throw your ball that almost guarantees you a strike every single time.
Okay.
And you get a lot of money by doing this. And so I made 30,000 rupees off of playing bowling for a couple of hours, which is a lot
When were you doing this, Bobby? Explain to the...
During the Super Bowl. Uh-huh. During the entire Super Bowl. And I walked out 30,000 rupees richer.
Yep.
But that's not interesting.
And I'm so proud of you.
The thing that struck me is because I had to listen to this NPC, which is a non-playable character. It's a person in the world who is not important to the game. This guy who has created this snowball bowling. Like, I took 30,000 rupees off of him. Basically just so he could watch me bowl, and I started to feel really bad about it.
Oh my god.
Because I was assigning too much meaning, but then like partway through I was like, he's really excited to watch me bowl. And then I just got creeped out. Like, I feel like this guy has a fetish for watching Link.
This is what happens when you do something that wasn't designed to be done for 3.5 hours. You assign this narrative to it that's just so fucking insane.
But now I'm totally fine with it because that guy's a creep.
Well,
and I want to take all of his money.
I'm so glad you reached that emotional place in your journey. That's really
comforting. Has enough money to supply me to save Hyrule from Ganon, and he's not just offering it, he's making me like stand in front of his house and throw snowballs down a mountain in order to give it to me, then like, yeah, fine, whatever, that guy sucks.
Bobby, I brought a letter that I want to read with you. We brought you here today because we're all concerned.
It's really great. I take it back what I said a few weeks ago.
Yeah, you were talking a little bit of shit on it. Not a lot, but a little bit. And now you're like more into it than I am. I think you probably put double the amount of time into it that I did.
I've put a lot of time. And then I was really sad because I was going into the final fight. And then I realized a bunch of the DLC got triggered. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to put off this final fight for a long time. Because I know as soon as I beat Ganon, I'm like not going to go back to the game.
Right, right. That was the mistake I made. I will say about Xenoblade, I've played about 40 hours of it, and I haven't touched any of the side missions, really, and I'm pretty sure I'm not even, or maybe I'm just about halfway done. So it's a huge game. And it really, really scratches the Final Fantasy VII itch. It, like, feels very old-school JRPG, steampunk, like, fun.
I have Final Fantasy VII on my phone.
Yeah, I should do that.
Oh, you know what? I have Final Fantasy 15 on my phone as of last night.
15? The newest one?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Pocket Edition came out.
I still actually haven't really played that game.
Apparently, I was reading a thing on Kotaku about it today, and apparently the mobile version is really streamlined, and they take away a lot of, like, the exploration, like the fetch questy exploration stuff, which, like, if you're into that stuff, that sucks, but... The writer of the Kotaku article is like, I'm having more fun with the Pocket Edition than I do with the console
version.
Interesting.
How are the graphics?
I mean, they're good for what they are. You saw what it looks
like,
right?
Yeah.
They replaced.
I just haven't seen it in motion.
They replaced the photoreal kind of.
It looks like
Final Fantasy
it looks like
stuff.
Final Fantasy VII, kind of, right? Like, it's bulky, like polygon
it looks,
people.
It's smoother than that, but they're all like these cute little. Okay. Cartoony characters instead of but it's fully voice acted
yeah,
too
yeah. Oh, so it's is crazy. So Xenoblade is also, and they do this really weird thing that it took me a while to figure out, where there's like two main countries, and for whatever reason they gave one of the countries all Scottish accents and the other country all Australian accents. So like every person in this game has some crazy accent. It's really weird.
That's fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else?
What else have I been doing? I've been watching the show Face Off. I'm kind of obsessed with it, and I
what?
Go ahead.
What is it?
Okay.
No, what is it?
Okay, so I don't normally go for reality TV. I think I got into King of the Nerds a few years ago, and that was like, but it, you know, and reality TV's dumb. Like, it's, especially if you binge watch it, it's the same thing over and over. But Face Off is a sci-fi original reality show about monster makeup. About like special effects makeup, so it's really, really perfect, right? Because, and it's still, it's exact same formula of every other reality show. It's just like 12 people in a house who have to do all these challenges every week, but it ends with these amazing sculptures on people. Like they have to in 4 days completely design, sculpt, and apply a makeup to a model, and then they come out on stage and judge the models at the end. And it's fantastic. Like, the everybody on it's super talented. It's super satisfying to watch at the end. You can, like, do something else and then just watch the last 20 minutes, like, really, because that's when you actually see all the performances. And it's great. And there's, like, 10 seasons of it. So it just is, like, a really easy...
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's been on forever. I liked it.
Yeah, I've never heard of it.
Yeah, I watched it when it first came on. It's actually a fairly big show, I believe. I think it's pretty... like well received. I think it's considered a pretty big hit for sci-fi. They, because especially in like early seasons, they try to do some stuff where they're like, oh, America can vote live, and they eventually get rid of most of that. But it's great. You should definitely check it out. It's really fun.
I will.
Yeah,
that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's a great show. So I've been watching a lot of that.
I haven't been watching. I just finished. Have you decided to watch the new season of Good Place yet? Or are you still waiting?
I was going to, and then they do. It's not available anywhere that I can stream it. So I totally want to, and I have not yet.
You can't do it off of like the is it NBC?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. You always have to sign into those, and I don't have cable, so I don't think I would be able to. I don't know. Maybe it's on there without having to sign in. I definitely will watch it if it's on there. An easy way to watch.
That show is incredible, and it reinvents itself like every week.
Yeah, I follow a lot of the writers, so whenever I see like tweets and stuff about them, I just kind of scroll past it because I really don't want to miss. I don't want to get any spoilers. And from what I've heard, the season two ends really amazingly well too. And yeah,
I cannot get over how good that show is. And I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise because all the writers are great, right. And you know, Michael Schur is great, and the cast is incredible, but that show's, like, one of my favorite shows.
Wait, say that thing about Michael Schur again.
He's great?
Yeah, he sure is.
Oof. All right. Well, this
has been... We're going to edit that together so I sound really clever.
Nope. I also just...
Did you finish the second season?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Was it as good as the end of the first season?
Yeah, it's not as surprising.
Okay.
Because
that's not what I mean. I don't mean is it like a big twist, yes, or whatever. I just mean, yeah, okay, cool.
It ends on a moment that made me sigh. I loved it so much.
Cool.
Yeah.
Wow. This ending made me sigh. That's a great blurb. They should put that on the poster if they made posters for TV shows.
Listen,
Bobby,
no one's
Mattern,
gonna tell you this because they're afraid of confrontation. Sigh. But you're an asshole. And everyone thinks you're an asshole. I finished a book for the first time. in like a month.
Yeah. Right?
But yeah, I finished a book this week, which was exciting.
What did you read?
Well, no, I can't tell you because now I'm going to diminish my own thing.
What?
All right. So it was an audiobook. It's a book called Unbelievable by Katie Turr, who is an NBC and MSNBC contributor. And she was part of the press core for the Trump campaign.
Okay.
Like, she followed the Trump campaign around.
Okay.
And it's about
does
her...
that song that goes, oh, you're unbelievable, does that play underneath
yes.
the whole thing?
Underneath the entire yeah. audiobook, all many, many hours of it. It's just a loop of the chorus,
seems,
not even the rest
like
of the song.
Seems like a strange choice, but... Cool.
Yeah, yeah, it's a little bit distracting. You can tell Katie Turr gets distracted during parts of it. She'll start to hum along with it.
Oh, she can hear it. It's not like added in later.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
No,
yeah,
no,
okay.
no. They have the group in studio with her
okay.
performing the chorus over and over again.
That sucks for them.
Yeah, yeah. No, from what I heard, they made like $30 million because that was such an outrageous thing to demand of them. But I got it a while ago, and I figured it was just going to be like another, another political book about how insane and unbelievable like the Trump campaign was.
Did you seek it out? What brought you to the book?
I like Katie Turr.
Okay.
I think she's cool. And she was on Pod Save America a couple months ago, and I got her audiobook right after that, but didn't listen to it because I didn't have I wasn't in the right state of mind to listen to it.
Right, right.
But what it actually is kind of just a really interesting, it's her personal account of like where she is in her career and kind of like the toll it takes to be on the road following a campaign. I mean, it's about Trump, but it's mostly about her and her experiences and
cool.
kind of the life of a political reporter, but also about, you know, Trump singling her out and fucking with her on the campaign
right,
trail.
Right.
And that stuff is really crazy to listen to, but I highly recommend it.
Okay.
I enjoyed that book.
Okay. I listen to audiobooks all the time, by the way. I don't think you should be embarrassed by listening to audiobooks.
Parading it around is an accomplishment. Like Katie Turr finished reading her book to me.
Fair. Fair.
Yeah.
Oh man. Do you want to jump into our conversation for the week?
Yes, let's.
Who are we doing first, you or me?
My thing is better than your thing.
I picked X-Files. This is one of probably the most important shows to me in the world. I think I talked about that last time a little bit, and I picked two episodes of the show. Thank you for doing two. I know I'm I'm a give a mouse a cookie kind of person sometimes, so I appreciate it.
You give mice cookies?
Yes, that's exactly what I meant. And I picked one that's really, really kind
of...
Oh, go ahead.
I give mice chips myself. I give them...
We're not allowed to say that word on the show anymore. I picked two episodes, one that is like super well known and super talked about, which is Clive Bruckman's Final Repose, and then a second one which I really like but is not as famous. I mean, it's a liked episode, called The Unusual Suspects, which I picked because of who it kind of spotlights. How much experience do you have with X-Files, like before now? Like, did you watch the show ever growing up? Did you see any of the movies? Like, what was your connection?
The first episode of X-Files, and I have watched the Simpsons X-Files crossover.
Okay.
That's
a great episode.
It's a great episode.
It actually is really like, it apes the kind of directorial style of X-Files really well, which I thought was interesting. So you see, why did you watch the first episode? You tried to start the show and then just didn't get into it?
I might have watched the second episode,
okay,
too. There's no way. There's no way of knowing.
Yeah, there's definitely a bunch of episodes in season one that are worth skipping.
I think I might have even started watching it because you were telling me to watch X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
And you even told me there are a bunch of episodes worth watching, like worth skipping in season one at first.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I'm gonna watch it all.
Yeah. With like 90s network television, like they just don't have enough to fill 24 episodes sometimes, you know? So like by later in the show, the filler actually kind of, like, so the show is kind of built around, there's this obvious, like, alien conspiracy is the main thing, and those are kind of referred to as the mythology episodes, and then there's Monster of the Week episodes, which are often considered the filler, although I think some of them can be really important to character development. Early on, the ones you really wanted to see were the mythology episodes. Then by season six, like late season six, the mythology starts to fall apart a little bit. It goes into the same territory as like Lost does and stuff like that. And the Monster of the Weeks become kind of the point of the show. There's some really great episodes. The show also has a really good sense of fun to it that people often aren't aware of, which is I kind of picked two slightly comedic episodes to share with you because there's a really fun sense of play in both of them, I think. So let's actually start with The Unusual Suspects, because I think that's slightly weaker of the two, even though I still really like it. So this episode is about Mulder before he, you know, kind of took on the X-Files, while he's still like a golden boy at the FBI meeting.
But it's,
yeah.
It's not even really about Mulder.
It's not. I think it's
more about the lone gunmen meeting each other than it is about them meeting.
You're right. This is kind of the Mulder. Lone gunman origin story. And the lone gunmen are kind of my favorite secondary characters of the show. They're definitely there for comic relief, but they're really sweet and they're really like kind of great nerdy allies to Mulder and Scully in the show. The show does a really good job of setting up these people who are kind of silly because of the world that they exist in, but they're also really courageous, and the lone gunmen are absolutely that. And they definitely save Mulder and Scully's life on lots of occasions in the show. The weirdest aspect of the lone gunmen is that they made a TV show spinoff of the lone gunmen that which wasn't very good. Do you know the trivia I'm about to share?
No.
The pilot episode is about a thwarted attack on the Twin Towers by crashing into them with airplanes about 6 months before 9/11 happened.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Oh, my God. In a show that is named for a government conspiracy.
Yes. Yeah.
Also.
Yeah. That's one of my biggest like things with X-Files that's kind of hard for me is like the politics of that show, just by the nature of what it is, get really, really confusing, because like now we live in a world where like conspiracy theorists are the alt-right, you know what I mean? Like, and
yep.
For instance, in the X-Files movie, you find out that FEMA is basically run by a shadow organization that is trying to orchestrate a global collapse. So because FEMA, if in the event of collapse, like gets to dictate what happens governmentally, and so it's like they're gonna stage a coup by creating a plague, so like FEMA are the bad guys, which is like a super crazy like right-wing nut job kind of thing to talk about, but overall I love the show. I think Mulder and Scully
is this is the show that Alex Jones binge watches
in
between like a million lines of cocaine.
Yeah. it's a really, really good show, though. What did you think of The Unusual Suspects?
I liked it a lot. Unusual Suspects was definitely my least favorite of the two,
uh-huh.
but I still liked it.
Uh-huh.
I do feel like there's a lot of, like, a lot of the coming together moments are moments that were a little bit lost on me.
Okay.
Just because I don't speak the language of the series.
Right. So one of the things that I think is fun about that episode, and X-Files actually does this a lot, it does it a little more comedically here than normal, but it does it really well. The lone gunmen are essentially brought together at this tech convention because this woman, this like beautiful, mysterious woman, who's very obviously conning them, like we can see it coming a mile away, brings them all together because she says she's being chased by her old boyfriend. It turns out to be Mulder, and he's trying to get her because she escaped from some facility and the FBI was sent after her. But then we find out that the reason for all of this is because there's some kind of government weaponized gas that's been created that creates obsession with conspiracies and extreme paranoia in the subjects. And at the end of the episode, in the last third of the episode, Mulder and all of the lone gunmen get hit with it really bad. And so it's very, very unclear, like, what's real and what's not the whole time. Like, how much of what she's saying is bullshit and how much of it is true. And I thought that was very fun.
It's smart. I'm assuming this, it's interesting, you know, with the knowledge of who the lone gunmen are and having seen them appear in other episodes. But, the episode centers around Byers.
Right.
Who's the main character of the episode.
Yes.
Would you agree?
Yes.
Like he's the one who has to undergo a change. Like he's the one who, at the beginning of the episode, he works for the FCC, which is pretty funny.
Right. And Byers is the one who has the biggest change into this anti-government person. And, mm-hmm. and that the character we see in that episode is pretty much retained. He's a really quiet, obviously really intelligent, sweet guy who dresses really, really nice because he's kind of a dork, and you know, that's about it.
And stalks pretty ladies all around the convention.
Yeah.
But it's okay because he's a nice
guy. I was thinking that too.
But and I'm assuming, you know, like Frohickey and Langley don't really change,
right? They're like, they're already anti-government kind of from the beginning. Rock hacker types, yeah. By the way, Frohickey is not an actor. He was like a grip on the first season, and they just cast him because they thought he looked the part.
Yeah, he looks very distinct. Yeah. He's very he's like, if you I'm trying to think of who he looks like. Like a kind of like a toady Timothy Spall,
yes,
maybe.
Yes, that's 100% right. And he kind of acts like the guy who's never actually kissed a girl, who really is trying hard to prove that he's not afraid of women. Like he's like very overly like has a ton of bravado about women and like talks about like dames and stuff, but he's like obviously just a huge dork too. One of the running jokes in the show is he hits on Scully all the time, and somehow they walk the line of it being like really cute, and she kind of just rolls her eyes at him, and he's like a little bit doing it for fun too. And then Langley is the like fuck everything, let's burn it to the ground, I'm really into the Ramones guy.
Uh-huh.
They were originally thought up by Chris Carter while he was at an airport, and there was three guys who looked exactly like that handing out UFO literature. and he like was obsessed with how three men who looked like that ended up together, and so he wrote them into the show.
That's great.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say about that first one? I think
no, it's fine. I think I'll have more to say about. Hang on, let me retake that line.
Sure.
I think I'll have more to say about it in relation to the other episode, but
also something important about this episode, Scully's not in it at all. This is, right. I think, one of like three episodes or four episodes of Scully's not in at all in the entire show.
From what I understand, it was because they had to work around shooting the X-Files movie.
Yes, yeah.
That's what the Wikipedia said. But what I perhaps didn't like as much was the like the character stuff was more, it was more of a straightforward kind of episode. Mm-hmm. Like the plot development was like a little bit more on rails, and it was still good. It was still competently done. All those characters were likable, but it was kind of just slowly watching it play out
right
into the direction.
Yeah, one of the reasons I picked it, in addition to the fact that I just liked the Lone Gunman, is I wanted, there's so many episodes of X-Files that are very postmodern. The next one we're going to talk about is like that. It dissects the show and asks why these characters are the way they are and what that means, and in these ways that, like, you know, Watchmen does with superheroes and stuff like that. But that's not effective if you don't already know the characters. So I wanted to give you a more straightforward episode too, to give you kind of a sense of the baseline. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah. So let's talk about Clive Bruckman, because this episode is amazing. What's his name? Boyle. What's his first name? What's wrong with me?
Peter Boyle.
Peter Boyle
incredible.
Yeah, he's amazing in this episode. He won an Emmy for his performance in it. What'd you think of Clive Bruckman?
That was great. I really, really dug
it. It's kind of a perfect script, right?
Yeah. I mean, on a very basic level, what I was caught off guard, what I really took to you right away. So Clyde Bruckman is a...
Yeah, why don't you kind of summarize the episode?
He can see the future, but he can only see death.
Yes.
He can only see how people die.
Right.
Which, he's not really shy about.
Yeah, he doesn't really try to hide it, but he also just doesn't give a shit. So, like...
Right.
He seems to lead a life where people don't pay attention to him, so it's never come up before.
Yeah, and he's really, I mean, you also get the sense that he's just really worn down from having these powers. But that's nice because you get all the bullshit about him trying to hide the fact that he has powers out of the way.
Right, right.
Because this episode, and I'm assuming a lot of X-Files episodes, it starts to, it kind of apes the structural language of procedurals,
yeah,
which I don't really like.
Okay.
So when he starts talking about, at the very beginning, there's a murder. We see the killer of the episode, he murders a fortune teller, and Clyde Bruckman finds the fortune teller's body. And Mulder and Scully sit down with Clyde and ask him about the, you know, they ask him what he saw, and as a witness, he gives them way more information than he should know.
And you immediately watch Mulder get really excited. Mulder's journey in this episode is really funny to me because obviously you know even if you've never seen the show, you know that Mulder's the believer. This is his religion. Scully is the skeptic, right? That's how every X-Files works.
And I'm sure you do this too. As someone who like constantly, you know, like as someone who's like taking apart a narrative as it's happening, I'm like, this is stupid, you know, because I was really afraid that he was going to become the prime suspect because he was talking too much.
Right.
And then the show just blows right.
Right. Right.
You're like,
yeah.
Nope, they don't. Clearly he's not the suspect, but they catch on right away that he has powers, and it's the rest of the show is them dealing and kind of like parsing his powers.
One of the funniest things to me in this episode is Mulder's frustration with the fact that he's like literally just sitting in the car with a demonstrably provable psychic who like just will not give him any answers, like
right.
Like he asks these super nerdy questions and Clive's just like, I don't know, like I don't know, like what do you want from me? He's just crazy grumpy old man. It's very fun. Well, for me,
and a thing that's really really interesting, this is what I was talking about, or what I really took to, so Clyde is really like fatalistic.
Yes.
he doesn't want to change anything about what he sees because he's afraid of the greater implications that might have to the universe. And so he leads a really sad life where, you know, he sees his recluse next door neighbor and looks at her dog and then sees that she's going to die and her dog's gonna like eat her,
right?
You know,
yeah. By the way, that dog stays in the show after he gives him to Scully for like two seasons.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And then he gets eaten by a monster. It's kind of sad.
No, I don't like that. Don't tell me that. But I like that
she names her dog Queequeg. Her and her dad called each other Starbuck and Ahab, so she names the dog Queequeg.
That's cute.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry, I'm nerding out.
The thing I really like is that his version of like using his powers for good is by selling insurance. Like, he sells people life insurance.
Yeah. But that's, like, kind of shitty of him. Like, he just, like, he is also just a salesman who wants to make money. Like, he's not, like, a hero, but he is, like, but he's actually trying to explain to them that they do need this. It's so...
I took it as a good thing because, like, you don't want your people who are buying life insurance from you to die.
Right,
because then you have to pay out on their policy.
That's true. You're right. I didn't think of it that way.
He's just trying to talk people into getting life insurance because they'll need it,
yeah.
You know? And so he has a moment with a guy at the beginning who doesn't want to buy insurance from him. He's like, you don't get it. You're going to, like, die in a miserable car accident. But he gets into, like, big, like, real gory detail.
Yeah,
you're going to be ejected from your seat. And the only thing that is going to be, you know, you're going to be as indistinguishable as the road that you slide half a mile down. Like, that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Which I thought was just, that was really interesting. Mm-hmm. That was something I've never seen before.
I agree.
And I love that.
I like that too. I think one of my favorite aspects of this episode is the villain, who the serial killer is killing psychics. And he's doing it for what he would consider to be no reason. Every single time he kills somebody, he asks them to tell him why he's doing it. Because he himself also is a psychic, or at least believes he's also a psychic, and sees himself doing this, therefore he does it. But he doesn't understand why. And he finally has this confrontation with Bruckman at the end where he asks him very, very sincerely why he does it, and Bruckman just looks at him and goes, don't you get it? you kill because you're a homicidal maniac. And the guy sits down with a big grin on his face and looks very relieved and says, yeah, that would explain a lot, wouldn't it? I really like the play with predestination that this gets into. Because, you know, in shows like this, and there's other shows like X-Files, you know, psychics are obviously a big part of it. I've never seen a show grapple this much with what the ramifications of that would actually mean.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, and... the thing I loved about this episode, again, is that it's way more concerned about dealing with those ramifications than building a mystery.
Yes.
Or even catching the bad guy. Yeah. Like, the evidence
that Mulder and Scully are not the main characters of this episode. Clive is the main character.
Right. And in the evidence that leads Scully back to we find out that the killer works at a hotel.
Yes.
The hotel that that Bruckman and
that,
Mulder
that they take him to protect him from the serial killer, which is really fun. And the killer is surprised he's there. This episode like has so many things to say about coincidence and fate and predestination. It's so fun.
And the evidence that gets them there is that there's a fiber of silk that keeps appearing at crime scenes, and Scully finally figures out it's from like the napkin,
the cloth napkin on the tray.
Which is dumb, but like it's okay because it doesn't matter.
Well,
you know?
Also it's super dumb, but so here's the thing, like that's dumb. That's a big coincidence. Him showing up at the same hotel is dumb and a coincidence, but they point that out and the characters are like, wow, that's a crazy coincidence. And she realizes it right after this police officer has this huge speech about how they don't need psychics anymore. They have science. They don't have to rely on hunches. And then she sees that and runs out. And the cop asks Mulder what she's doing. And Mulder says, I don't know, women's intuition, and runs out after her, which is a fun little moment too.
Yeah, it's great.
Scully's great in this episode, by the way. You get to see a softer side of her. Unfortunately, because of the... you know, premise of the show, she's kind of, you know, I watch this show on Hulu, and like any episode where there's a big fight between Mulder and Scully, like there's so much hate for Scully in the comments. People are just like, why doesn't she just die? And she's right too. Like Mulder's not perfect. He has his flaws, and he looks for things, for answers where there shouldn't be, and all this stuff. And I'm a big believer in Scully as being like just as productive on the team as he is, if not more so. So it's fun to see her kind of take a liking to Clyde, and there's
a really great moment, you know, like right at the third act, mm-hmm. probably, where Scully and Bruckman sit down, and Bruckman has told Mulder how he's going to die, or how he sees Mulder dying, which ends up just it ties into the climax of the episode. But then he and Scully talk
actually
about...
really quick, he doesn't say that Mulder's gonna die there. He says that he sees the killer having a vision there. He also you could make the argument more so that he tells Mulder he's gonna die from autoerotic asphyxiation, which is so, and I'll get back to that in a minute because there's a reason for that, but continue.
But Bruckman says that he sees him and Scully in bed together, and there's a gross moment where Scully's like, "Come on," and then and this is so much of this is Peter Boyle just selling the shit out of the scene.
100%.
Because, like, I kind of like gagged at that line, and then he says it just so softly and so like it's a great scene of acting, and he talks about how it's not that, you know, she's holding his hand, and you know, he looks up at her in total relief, and he's just so grateful.
And he says tears are streaming down his face.
And it's a moment that neither of them will ever forget. And you know what that moment is. Mm-hmm. As he's saying it, like you're not like thinking like, oh, Bruckman and Scully are gonna get together. You know that he's describing his own death,
right.
But it's just a really nice moment, and when that moment inevitably comes up at the end, because you find out Bruckman at the very end has killed himself, and you know there's
which by the way he has a vision of early on in the episode. Does he? Yeah, he takes a bag of lettuce out of the fridge and looks at it, and he sees his own head in the face of the lettuce in a bag, which is how he kills himself. He puts a plastic bag over his head. So again, it comes down to, like, did he do that because he wanted to, or did he do that because he did it? Like, is it that just what he's going to do?
Yeah. It's good, yeah. Man. It's really good.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, so there's a huge, like, conversation around this episode because he tells Mulder that he's probably going to die from autoerotic asphyxiation. Sorry, I can't say that. And then he tells Scully asks him how she's going to die, and he smiles and says, "You don't." Which, you know, who the hell knows what that means? A bunch of people have, like, really dumb, in my opinion, theories about that. But one of the running jokes of the show, which makes the Mulder joke a lot funnier, is Mulder's really into porn. Like, he's got, like, there's episodes where, you know, he'll switch bodies with somebody else, and that person will go to his apartment, and there'll be a closet just full of porn. Or, like, Scully will call him, and he's clearly watching porn in the background. And it's a joke, but it also comes from the fact that he's just, like, on a mission, and he doesn't have time for a relationship, so he just watches porn instead. So, like, Mulder being kind of, like, a little bit of a pervert is being played with here, I think, which is fun.
And what, Scully becomes immortal?
Yeah, exactly.
Did you take that to mean that, or did you take that to mean...
No, I don't think... I think a lot of people stupidly are like, yeah, Scully's never gonna die. I don't think that's what that means. I mean...
Because Clyde...
Scully's biology is played with on the show. Like, she's abducted on occasion and things like that. So people are like, yeah, it's because of that. That's stupid. I'm not a fan of that.
People play with her biology?
Oh my god.
That's not cool. That's really disturbing.
You know what I mean. You're right. That sounded real gross. I didn't mean it like that.
But the line about Scully not dying is because Clyde Bruckman sees the vision of Mulder and assumes that Mulder is going to die,
right,
or entertains that idea, right, and Scully lives past Bruckman, yes, and he's kind of relieved that he can't see someone's death.
I agree with that too.
Okay.
I also think one of the really fun things at the end is that it's very unclear whether Mulder and Scully change the future because of the prediction of how Mulder dies that Bruckman shares with them, or if Bruckman just shared a vision of what the killer saw and the killer was wrong in the first place because he's not really psychic. So it's, like, very much left up to interpretation whether they break the rules of fate or whether fate is inescapable and they just don't already know what it is.
That's interesting. Yeah. I love that. I like playing with that.
Yeah, me too. So anyway, so that's X-Files. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
The truth is out there.
Yeah.
Sir.
Basically, if you ever want to watch more X-Files, I can tell you some fun one-offs to watch. Basically, anything Darren Morgan wrote was great. That's the guy who wrote Clive Bruckman.
There are two moments I want to... Sorry, I forgot to touch upon.
Oh, please.
There's one cheesy moment where there's a big wide shot at the end of a conversation of Bruckman, Scully, and Mulder standing in a forest.
Mm-hmm.
And Bruckman says, "I can't see the forest or the trees."
I like that. I thought that was him making a cheesy joke, not the writers thinking they were funnier than they were. But I agree.
The camera assisted with that joke, and I'm like, oh, come on.
I really like the joke right before that where he explains how he got his powers. He says he was a bigger fan of the Big Bopper than Buddy Holly, and he read about how the Big Bopper got on a plane, the plane he crashed in because he won a coin flip, and how he became obsessed with that, and blah blah blah, and like
that's
gets this
great.
Huge, and then they go, Scully goes like, "Okay, nice story, dude," and he goes, "I know, it's unbelievable. I really liked the Big Bopper more than Buddy Holly." It's just, like, so cheesy and fun. I love Peter Boyle so much.
Yeah, man. R.I.P.
Yeah, no kidding. He was brilliant.
I mean, even in, like he's in Taxi Driver, and he's
so good.
Runs away with every scene he's in Taxi Driver.
He's amazing in Young Frankenstein. He's unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. You said there was a second point you wanted to make?
Oh, this, and I'm tying it back to Zelda, because this is me overthinking. This is me overthinking NPCs.
Well, also, you have no other frame of reference in your life right now.
I don't.
You've
I
done
really
nothing
don't.
Else.
Listen, I have been playing Zelda this entire time. I always feel, like, unreasonably bad for the red shirt who gets killed, like, at the final confrontation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, there's this detective who Mulder and Scully entrust with protecting Bruckman yeah. when they leave to investigate the
new murder,
a new crime. Yeah. Yeah, new murder. And you know his role is to get killed.
Of course.
Like, as soon as he's introduced, like, you're like, that guy's gonna die. And they humanize him for just a moment, and then he gets stabbed.
They humanize him really well. He asks Clive Bruckman if he's going to die from lung cancer, and he looks terrified, and Bruckman just shakes his head no, and he looks like he's going to cry in relief and then lights a cigarette. It's an amazing moment.
And Peter Boyle, fucking acting the shit out of this episode, smiles in a way that you know he's happy that that dude gets his last cigarette.
Yeah, 100%.
Oh, God, damn it. Yeah. Peter Boyle is so good in this episode. Yeah. But, No, yeah, I always feel bad. There's a moment in L.A. Confidential. Have you ever seen L.A. Confidential?
No, I actually never have. That's a big blind spot for me.
There's a moment at the end where one of our main characters is going to go investigate a investigate something. And then just a background cop goes, oh, hey, are you going to go investigate this? I'll come with you. Mm-hmm. And then that guy gets killed. And then, like, my brain can only go to, like, man, what was that guy doing earlier that day? Like, if he had just gone to the bathroom when Russell Crowe left the building, he would have still been alive.
If he just hadn't flipped that coin and gotten on the plane with Buddy Holly.
Yep. Got it. Okay. Yeah. I mean, like, yes, this episode is great.
I'm a little bummed that I gave you the other one. It's a good episode. It's just not like,
no, it's great.
I mean, there's other better episodes to share. I just really wanted to give you a baseline episode. And I thought that would
which
be fun.
I watched them in chronological order. I actually meant
to tell you to do it the other way, and I totally forgot. So that's on me.
No. But I don't want you to think I didn't like the other episode.
No,
I
understand.
It's just,
I mean, Clive Bruckman's just a perfect script. It's great.
It's really good.
Okay. Well, let's move on to your pick of the week.
Experience Bobby. I picked a very like a really niche indie show called Lost.
This is probably the most mainstream thing you've picked, I would say.
Yeah, because I really took the Bobby picks pretentious things to heart. Yeah.
And then you picked the one episode that is not like any other episode of the entire show.
I picked Nikki and Paolo's Final Repose.
Yeah, you really did.
Okay, I picked an episode called Exposé. And I kind of, it's an episode from season 3. Season 3 is the last good season front to back of Lost, okay. I think. And season 3 has problems. It's not a perfect season of TV at all, and it's hard to take any single season of Lost on its own without the whole knowing where that show ended up going. But
every time people die in this episode, I'm like, well, then are they in limbo or not? What's happening here? By the way, it's big spoilers for Lost, I guess we should say. Sorry.
And we'll get into what exactly the fucking point of Lost was.
I don't know if we need to do that.
No, because I think it's important to this episode. Okay. And but anyway, so Lost, season 3, I think it's actually at the end of season 2. The format of Lost is that each episode, Orange is the New Black also kind of has this format where each episode focuses on one person on the island. And then interspersed in between what's going on the island, you get a flashback of what happened to this person.
Or a flash off sideways. The island.
Season 3, we're still doing flashbacks. We don't have to deal with that other bullshit.
Have you watched Lost since like it was on? Have you rewatched it?
I watched some episodes. Okay. I haven't watched it all.
I think, my first time returning to the show since it was on television. I think.
Did you? had you watched this? I want to keep talking about it, but have you watched this episode? Do you remember this one at all?
I don't remember this at all, which is actually really surprising to me. I understand totally why you picked it, because I could see 20 to 25 year old Bobby being really into this idea. I would have been too. I liked it. I do like it. I was struck by a couple of things. I was struck by how much more of a network TV show this looks like than I remember.
I remember it looking like very like prestige TV, and I mean, it's well shot. It's not like badly shot, but I mean, like the measuring stick for that has just changed so much. I would I was ready to watch it and for it to look like Breaking Bad, and it just doesn't.
Lost is culturally important in that I think it was the beginning of a new wave of network prestige TV.
I agree. But it was the beginning of it. So it just, it is dated for sure.
It still looks good.
It's great. It's great. It was really fun for me to watch, all of these people again. There's a lot of stuff that I don't remember the context of. So there's like definitely some stuff with, Sun and Sawyer and the guns and all this stuff that I don't remember exactly, where they are. But I enjoyed this a lot. It's a very clever idea. Why don't you explain like what the premise is?
Let me get into the back. Yeah. So at the end of season two, they introduce these characters named Nikki and Paulo.
Oh, they're actually, they're only in, I thought they were there. Like, I thought they were background extras the whole time.
They are not background extras. They kind of get, they get introduced, I think, in the finale of season two. They just randomly show up, they're taking volunteers to go to the Pearl Station, which factors into this episode.
Right.
And Nikki just kind of raises her hand, and everyone's like, who the fuck is that?
But within the narrative, it suggests they're supposed to have been there the whole time. Like, they're,
They crashed with the plane.
And the show has done that before. Like, there's members of the – who have landed who aren't main characters on the show. Like, it's not just the –
Not a ton, though.
It was fun. Like,
post season one, like, none of them really get speaking roles at all.
Yeah.
So it's weird that, like,
but they're there in the background, right? Like, there's other people there, aren't there?
Yeah.
Okay. That's all I'm saying. And that's what I thought these guys were. I thought they were like background extra people who had also crashed in the plane, but they just weren't main characters.
Right. No. I mean, that's what they're supposed to be, but these two had not shown up before.
Okay.
And so. They keep just randomly showing up throughout the third season, and people got really frustrated with them because people are dumb.
Yeah.
Like, I never thought that they were anything harmful or anything. Right. And so this episode comes, which is about as standalone of an episode as Lost gets.
Yes, and it's basically the Forrest Gump of Lost, I would say.
Yes,
yeah.
And people hated this episode because also within the context of the larger season – you know, mystery boxes were being opened left and right, things were ramping up, and then we essentially took a week off
to have this kind of clever comedy meta moment
to drop in on Nikki and Paulo, and people hated this episode. I think now that Lost is said and done, this episode's kind of fun.
I really enjoyed it.
So you want to talk, you want to like get into what happens in this episode?
So basically, this episode starts with Nikki like stumbling out of the jungle, falling down and dying in front of Hurley and Sawyer. By the way, like, it's insane to me how many of these character names I still remember.
It had a great cast of characters. Yeah.
By the way, I always remembered hating Matthew Fox's voice. He just has this like really nasally voice that doesn't match his heroic profile, and I did not make that up. He sounds crazy. Like, he has the weirdest, dorkiest voice I've ever heard in my life. Anyway, so the whole episode, and then they like go to look for whatever's happening. She says something as she collapses. Hurley thinks she says Paulo lies, and so they look for Paulo, and then they find him dead too. And then the whole episode is flashing back to them. We basically find out that they are con men who stole a bunch of diamonds and then ran away. And that over the course of the episode, they've been like lying to each other, trying to find the diamonds. Paulo found them. She tried to kill him. And then they both got, it's kind of complicated. They both got bitten by a spider that paralyzes you. And so what she actually said was, "I'm paralyzed," when she collapsed. And then the episode ends with the rest of the cast figuring out that they had stolen these diamonds, burying them with the diamonds, because what the fuck do they need with diamonds? And as they bury them, Nikki and Paulo coming back out of their paralysis and ostensibly dying from being buried alive, which is really fucking dark.
It's really dark.
I liked it a lot. There was a lot of fun cameos for me. We get to see Ian Somerhalder and Shannon from season one, which was fun because they die in season one, right?
Boone dies in season one. Shannon has recently died in the show. Okay. Or no, she dies in season two, I think.
We get to see, what's the creepy big-eyed guy from the others? What's his name?
Ben.
Yeah, we get to see Ben and
Juliet.
Juliet, thank you. What else? There's a bunch of fun stuff like that.
They are kind of, Nikki and Paulo, in their obsessive quest to find these diamonds, are adjacent to a lot of the discoveries in Lost, but they don't give a shit.
Yes.
You know,
so they find the plane that's crashed up in the air, which I believe is what kills Boone. And then they just keep going. They find the hatch before anybody else does and then just keep going. Or at least a hatch. I believe it's the Pearl
Station.
They find the Pearl Station.
Yeah.
I have a question really quick. Were Shannon and Boone dating or brother and sister?
Both, I think. They were step siblings.
Oh, okay.
But they, I think they slept together.
Oh, okay. She makes some crack about him being gay, and I was like, was he gay? And I don't remember that, but maybe she was just being mean to him. I don't know.
Shannon was just awful.
Yeah.
That's all.
Okay.
It's funny, because in their very first episode, when people were still reeling from, like, what the fuck are Nikki and Paulo doing here? There's a moment where they all go down to the Pearl Station. Nikki makes a discovery about the monitors and there being surveillance cameras, I think. And then there's, like, a toilet flush in that episode, and Paulo comes out of the bathroom. And everyone kind of looks at him and goes, oh, the toilet still works. And it's, like, this really weird moment of comedy in that episode. And this episode does something, I think, that's kind of fun with that, where you find out that Paulo had hid diamonds in the toilet of the of the Pearl Station.
Which, by the way, we should say Paulo is the fucking guy from Westworld. I really like him.
That's
he's
right.
He's also in Love Actually. He's the
Rodrigo Santoro.
Thank you. Yeah, he's the Hispanic bandit in Westworld. Anyway,
I totally forgot about Westworld. He's fine. Keely Sanchez, who plays Nikki, is not great. She's kind of a little bit annoying. Is not like a very good actor. I don't. Do you agree? Or am I being hard?
I think that's true. I was watching the whole episode assuming that they had been extras in the background without speaking parts this whole time. I didn't remember them actually, like, showing up the way they did. So I was thinking, like, oh, they're actually doing pretty good for that. But I guess if they actually were, like, full characters, you're right.
I
also didn't really – I looking back on it now, I'm like, oh, they clearly – like, the expose thing had nothing to do with this. They clearly only wrote – the fact that she starts off working on a TV show into the script so that they could have her in a bikini. Like, that's like, there's no other reason for that. Yeah. Like, it's crazy.
Well, also to have a cameo from Billy Dee Williams.
That was fun. I liked that.
That was really fun. Yeah. The thing I really like about this episode, is that, okay, so, like, now that Lost is all done, and we know what the creators were going for,
right, and
largely failed at,
was one of the best endings of television that I've ever seen.
But the idea that they very sort of they ham-handedly give you at the end is the idea that the show isn't about all these mystery boxes that they kept opening.
Right.
It's about these characters and how they grow and adjust to extraordinary events, and what kind of people, you know, these characters become when they're faced with a hard reset, like the island, you know, like that's very much.
And these two just stay shitty people.
And so
they're essentially punished at the end for being shitty people. That's
right. Yeah. What happens is a very straightforward morality play. And it's like not an accident that they interact with Sawyer in this episode.
Yes.
And Sawyer's also front and center, cause Sawyer's also a con man who also did a lot of shitty things before he got to the island.
Right.
And so, you know, Nikki and Paulo are faced with the opportunity to get better, and they spend literally their entire time on the island looking for diamonds, which they have no use for. And they literally kill each other looking for these diamonds.
Like, to
and
comic Sawyer effect, 100%. Like, even the way they kill each other is kind of silly when you say it out loud. Like,
it's really silly. Yeah. And do you remember Dr. Arst?
No, I was going to ask you about him. I have no recollection of him at all. I thought maybe he was another, like, funny...
He's great.
Like,
I'm going to tell you what he his moment of the show, and you'll totally remember him, because it's very memorable.
Okay.
At the end of the first season, they go to the ship that is on the island, has been on the island for years, and they find C4.
Yes.
That they're going to try to blow the hatch open with.
Yes.
And Arst is this really pompous teacher who knows more than everybody. And he is explaining to them, like, you have to be really, really careful with C4 or it'll explode. And then he has this moment where he's, like, giving a big monologue about how careless everyone on the island is. And everyone thinks that they're
right.
gods.
Yes.
They're invincible. And he's waving the C4 around and it explodes.
Yes.
And he dies.
I totally do remember that. I forgot about that. So was he a main character the whole first season?
No, he just shows up in that
okay.
episode. But when so it's fun that he's the recurring
yes.
Character that they interact
yes,
with
that's
because
really
he's
funny.
He's like the pre Nikki and Paula.
Yeah.
But I think it's great that this episode, I mean, for it being a departure from
sure.
a lot of the other mysteries, and a lot of these fucking mysteries worm their way into the episode, like the thing with Sun that I don't totally remember.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
There's also
it ends with
go ahead
it ends with a solid character moment for Sawyer where he has these diamonds and he dumps them into the dirt with these two other con men because there's no place for that, and Sawyer is growing as a character.
I thought it was really funny. One of the funny things, or kind of fun things for me, was to watch these mysteries be talked about very objectively in a situation where, like, you're removed from the emotional stakes of them because most of them have already happened. Like, they're things in the past, you know, them finding, talking about the others, the walkie-talkie, the hatch, the plane, like, all this stuff. And so, like, there's moments that are great where they'll just be like, somebody walks up to Desmond at one point and is like, well, can't you just use your, like, psychic powers and see what they're doing? Like, and they're just talking about it so matter-of-factly, and I'm like, oh, that's right. People have, like, visions on this show. That's fucking insane. Or the whole time they're, like, they're wondering how Paolo and Nikki died, and they're all just pretty much convinced it was a monster. They just keep saying a monster did it.
Yeah, and they're just really accepting, like, yeah, there's a fucking smoke monster
yeah,
on
yeah.
this island. Of course,
yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about, because Nikki and Paolo are these background characters who get introduced,
uh-huh.
and, like, the extras on the island slowly start to disappear.
Right.
Thinking about...
Does that mean they all went to heaven or hell? Is that what that's supposed to... Is that how we're supposed
well,
to understand
I mean,
that?
If you take that away, within the... If you take that garbage away, within the core timeline of Lost,
uh-huh.
like, the number of people who make it off the island... I can count on one hand.
Yeah,
you know, like,
it's like six people,
Kate,
right?
Sawyer. I think it's literally of the original castaways. It's Kate, Sawyer, Claire, and her baby. And I
oh,
think
is that
it?
Oh, okay.
I think Hurley stays behind on the
Jack
island.
Jack stays behind.
Jack dies on the
oh,
island.
Oh, that's right.
And then they all, yeah. I mean, like, so that's insane. That also in the background, hundreds of people are just dying.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And like we're just. Gonna not talk
I
about
will
that.
Say that they recreated the because I mean obviously very famously the first episode cost a lot of money, the plane crash
mm-hmm.
cost a lot. I would say for obviously having a smaller budget for this episode, because why would they have a big one, they recreated that very well.
It
felt like I was watching the pilot again.
I remember at the time, and I didn't do it this time, but I'm wondering because there's a moment where in the very first episode someone gets sucked into the turbine. Someone
yeah,
gets
no,
sucked
it's
into
the, it's the propeller, Bobby.
So, someone gets sucked into the turbine of the plane
propeller.
And it blows up a wing, and Locke beforehand goes like, hey, don't stand there. And I remember that from the first episode, but right before he says that in this episode, he has like a very brief interaction with Nikki. And like, I remember going back to the first episode to see if he had said that to anyone, and they were like retconning Nikki as that person, but I didn't watch it again, so I don't remember.
There's, I looked it up because I was like, what the hell? Ian Somerhalder, Boone, runs by asking for a pen, like really panicked, and then keeps running. And then I looked it up on the IMDb trivia. Jack like orders him to go find a pen so they can do a tracheotomy on somebody who's dying, which is really, that was really fun. I like that.
I remember that.
But they don't like give you context for that at all. You just have to remember it. I will say one of the things I laughed at the most, I always liked Locke. He's a really fun character for me. And I always really liked, especially younger me, like how he always talked in like Joseph Campbell-esque riddles. Like everything was like a thematic metaphor. And he literally walks up to Paolo while he's digging a hole and is like, you know, let me give you a piece of advice. Things don't stay buried on this island. And then he just stares at him and he's like, because the water's going to come in and wash it away. You should bury it somewhere else. And that's like, that's how Locke says everything. Like everything is just clearly the writers of the show being like, what do we need? What message do we need to convey today? Let's just have Locke say. So I thought that was kind of fun that Nikki and Paolo got one of those from Locke.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun. Well, it was really, it was just fun to return to the island. I enjoyed that.
That's what I took from it, too. I ended up watching two more episodes of this season that I knew I really liked. Okay. So
cool.
Yeah.
When was Michelle Rodriguez on it? Was this before or after?
Season two. Oh,
and she, and then they wrote her out, right? She dies at the end of season two?
She did.
That was when she like got in, she got a DUI or something, and so they killed her off?
I think that is probably what happened. I don't know. She kills Shannon.
That's right.
Yeah, and then Michael kills her.
Which,
right?
Who's Michael?
It doesn't matter.
Who's Michael? They kept talking about Harold, Michael, and I didn't remember him.
Michael is Harold Prineo. He has the young son.
Oh, Walt. Yeah, totally. Okay, got it. Yeah. Walt. Yeah. Okay, got it. I'm on board. You want to move on to our final conversation of the day?
Yeah, let's have one of these fights.
Well, I don't know if this one will be a fight or not, but so I suggested this week that we talk about the Marvel universe movies and what our favorites are.
I want to
tell on you. You don't get to tell on yourself.
But no, I'm not going to tell anything. I said that was a garbage idea because everyone knows the best superhero movie is Batman v Superman.
Yeah, you definitely did say that. No, what he actually said was, okay, and then texted me about an hour ago saying, wait, are we still doing a fight this week? And I said, yeah, aren't we doing the Marvel movies? And you basically said, oh shit, I forgot. And then about 5 minutes later, you texted me, let me find it because it's great. You wrote, oh wait, I think I did a ranking a few months ago. I broke them into tiers because it was impossible for me to break them without tiers. I have 5 movies in the top tier, though, so this should be fine. Like that, like you. Here's.
I have. My tiers, by the way, are, these are my faves. These are pretty good. These are all right. Not really a fan, no.
Okay. So do you want to? You want to get scientific? You want to get into them?
Yeah,
so I suggested we do the top 5. I tried to get one from each what are they called?
I could not. From each like hero? From
no,
each
no,
phase?
No, no. From like each what are they called?
Phase?
Like phase. Yeah, thank you. Each phase. So I think I got one at least from each phase.
I did not. Wow, I did not.
Interesting. So my number 5 is Blade.
Okay.
Just kidding. No, my number.
You did that, and I'm like, wait, we can do Blade. We can. You said the MCU. This is not fair.
So we should
specify. Yeah. We are doing the MCU,
yes,
which is all of the movies done under Marvel,
right,
under Marvel Studios.
Right.
So it doesn't count X-Men. It doesn't count the original Spider-Man movies
or Fantastic Four or anything like that. This is just
or Blade.
Yeah, or Blade. Yeah. So my number 5 is Thor 2.
Okay, try it again.
No. So yeah, do you want to go? We'll just.
I was gonna crack that joke. I'm not even kidding. I was gonna say my number 5 is Thor 2. I was gonna say Iron Man 2, but yeah.
Yeah, Thor 2, Iron Man 2. What do you think are the worst? Let's do that really quickly. I would say Thor 2, Iron Man 2, and Hulk. And I actually Hulk, but it's, you know, it's not great.
I think my, but like I think the rest of my not really a fan tier is maybe controversial a little bit.
Oh, okay, interesting. Well, let's save that because maybe it'll be one of my picks, and then we can fight about that. Why don't you go first?
Let me tell you, the Avengers is in. No, I'm joking. Yeah.
What's your number five?
My number five is Spider-Man: Homecoming.
Okay. I love Spider-Man: Homecoming. That is on my list, but it's not number five.
Really?
Yeah. Why did you pick it? I mean,
I picked Spider-Man: Homecoming. I love Spider-Man: Homecoming. I feel like it was nice to have the stakes feel a lot smaller in a Marvel movie.
Yeah, totally.
I think they lucked the fuck out with their lead because Tom Holland is great. God,
he's amazing. What's his name is an amazing bad guy. It's
this movie. Yeah, and it's fun that, I mean, people made jokes about, like, they should cast Michael Keaton as the Birdman after doing the Birdman.
Right.
And they did, and he's great.
Yeah, he's amazing. They get a really good job. They do a really good job with it being small in a lot of ways. It exists in the Marvel Universe, but the Marvel Universe doesn't take him seriously. As a bad guy, what the Vulture is doing is small enough that he's getting away with it. It's a working class hero movie of a mm-hmm. villain and a hero fighting each other. There's all kinds of fun.
Vulture is legitimately, I think, one of the most interesting villains.
Totally,
in the MCU.
Totally. In a universe with a lot totally of villain clear. Problems, I would say he's one of my favorites.
Yep, I would agree. The climactic fight between Spider-Man and Vulture is a little bit silly.
I'm not crazy about the plane, the invisible plane shenanigans. Once they land on the beach, I really have a fun time with that scene though.
The car ride that precedes all of that, where it is Michael Keaton driving Peter Parker to the prom.
That scene, by the way, spoilers for all these movies, just so everybody knows. That scene is incredible. That scene is absolutely
amazing.
Incredible. Yeah. That moment when Peter opens the door and Michael Keaton is there and you realize that he's Liz's dad is one of the best moments in any of the Marvel movies, in my opinion.
That's great.
My number five is Doctor Strange, which you might disagree on. I remember you getting kind of frustrated with that movie.
I do not like Doctor Strange.
Yeah. Do you actually not like it?
It is in that bottom tier for me.
Okay. Interesting. Wow.
I was thoroughly bored with Doctor Strange.
Yeah, so we've talked about this before. I understand that it follows a hero's journey in a fairly formulaic way, but I think every step of
it doesn't just follow the hero's journey. It follows Iron Man's journey with a new
character. Okay, wait. Iron Man's journey is the hero's journey. That's every character.
Uh-huh.
That's Captain America, too. That's just what superheroes do. They have a huge...
Captain America isn't like Soldier Tony Stark, but Doctor Strange is magical Tony Stark for sure.
I'm kind of fine with that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't hate this movie by any means.
Yeah, I'm not trying to pick too much of a fight. It's fine.
I think the set pieces all add something really unique to each area of this. So, like, for instance, the fights, the brawls are totally different. I think they're really fun. The way he beats the final boss is this really interesting outsmarting of him. It's really funny. I actually do like Benedict Cumberbatch in it a lot. I know you get bothered by his voice. I thought his voice was great. I enjoyed it. I thought it was a really, really fun.
I thought his voice was fantastic.
And Tilda Swinton's fantastic.
Tilda Swinton's amazing.
Yeah, totally.
How do they get these people in their Marvel movies? Yeah. These people who should not be in Marvel movies are in Marvel movies.
Tilda Swinton's the best in everything.
There's Donald Glover plays a tiny little part in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Oh, he's great.
And he makes the most interesting acting choices in that role to keep that character from falling into, like, a very obvious stereotype.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And does, like, a really interesting thing.
That's him and the script. I think it is both, to be fair. But I agree with you. Yeah.
It's great. Anyway, Doctor Strange. Yeah. It's visually, it is very interesting.
I would argue it's one of the most interesting. I would say for the most part, I zone out a little bit in Act 3 of these movies, unless there's a lot of character stuff going on in the fights, and I did not at all in this one.
Doctor Strange does have an interesting third act climactical battle with Dormammu. It's like that one is different than a lot of the other Marvel movies.
What's your number four?
My number four.
Did I say it like that, or are you just?
No,
okay.
I did.
I thought you were making fun of me. I was like,
no, I wasn't. Okay. I was making fun of me. My number four is Captain America: Civil War.
That is also on my list, but it is not my number four. That's a great movie.
It's great. Yeah. I love Civil War. I don't know. Where do we even start with Civil War? It's so fun.
Civil War is really fun. They managed to throw like 15 characters in there without making it feel bloated mm-hmm. or like an Avengers movie. It feels really small and contained. It's great. I think it does a really, really smart job of the final reveal. You spend the whole movie wondering how and why this would actually force Tony and Cap to fight each other like this. And that reveal that it's not actually about raising all these other super soldiers, but instead showing Tony that Bucky killed his parents is like an amazing, amazing moment. And that final fight, like, it makes me emotional. Like, it feels so tragic watching the two of them fight each other. And
I think Civil War has the best like bombastic action scene.
Yeah.
Out of the whole series.
They get to have this giant fun brawl, but then they also mm-hmm. get to have this heartbreaking personal struggle between these two characters. Yeah, totally.
That final battle between Cap and Iron Man and Bucky is so good.
It's great.
I think Zemo might be my favorite of the MCU.
Actually, I forgot about Zemo. I think he might be better than Vulture. But those are two of like maybe three or four that I could even pick between that are actually interesting.
I
actually really, really like Justin Hammer. Even though Iron Man 2 is not a great movie, I think he's one of my favorite villains. I really enjoy him.
That's Rockwell?
Yeah.
Yeah, Sam Rockwell's...
I mean, that's really the only reason why. It's because it's just Sam Rockwell being fucking weird. But it's great.
He's good. But yeah, no, I agree. The emotion's all there. We'll talk about it a little bit later, I guess,
so
too.
One of my... So my next one includes one of my favorite villains. It's one of the only villains that I really, really enjoy in the Marvel Universe. And that is Iron Man 3. Mm-hmm. Iron Man 3 is great. It's got Shane Black's fingerprints all over it in a perfect way. It's fun and funny. It's the first one that I remember actually dealing with the aftermath of the events that happened in the Marvel Universe in a totally believable mm-hmm. way. You get to see Tony like dealing with PTSD. And the way they take the Mandarin and just move it so far away from terrorism and all this shit that I was kind of worried they were going to do and take it into this kind of corporate manipulation of the world, I think was like really politically interesting and had interesting things to say. And Guy Pearce, and I feel like in my head, Guy Pearce and what's his name? Ben, what's the guy who plays Gandhi's name?
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Why did you do that?
What is wrong with me?
Ben Kingsley.
The two of them together, like, make that movie. Like, the transition mm-hmm. between them is so fun for me. I think Ben Kingsley is really fun and funny in that movie. Is great.
I think if it weren't for Civil War, this would be Robert Downey Jr.'s very best movie as Iron Man.
I agree.
I mean, any movie with Rebecca Hall is great.
Yeah, she's fantastic in it, too. That's right. I forgot she was even in that. Jesus.
I think this one is on my list as well.
Oh, cool.
The best movies in the MCU are movies that kind of play with the genre a little bit more in tone. Like, I loved Spider-Man Homecoming because clearly
it's a John Hughes movie.
That was the mission statement. We're going to do a John Hughes superhero
movie. I had to really struggle. Iron Man 3 I really had to struggle between Civil War and Winter Soldier because Winter Soldiers blew me away how they made their first real espionage movie.
Winter Soldier.
Okay, sorry.
But Iron Man 3, Iron Man 3 is a Shane Black movie.
Yeah, totally.
A superhero movie.
Yeah.
Love it.
And it also is the first one where you see that Tony is the weapon and not mm-hmm. the suit, which is always what's so fun to me, is Tony is his worst enemy. He's also his only real like source of strength. The suit, you know, you can blow up his whole ship, but he's going to go to the hardware store and take everybody out anyway. It was a great, 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 great movie.
Tony Stark is such a fascinating character because he is constantly, every movie he's in, he is destroyed. He learns a lesson. And the next movie completely fails at implementing that lesson.
Yes. You know? But it tries. And it's believable.
He's always trying.
Yeah. You should read Matt Fraction's Iron Man stuff. It's all excellent. I would say that's the closest... It's a really great run. It's called The Invincible Iron Man, and the art's amazing, and it's, I would say, the closest to cinematic Iron Man you see in the comic book universe.
Cool. Yeah. I love Matt Fraction's Hawkeye. Like a lot.
Yeah. I can actually give those to you if you want to borrow them sometime. So what's your number three?
Is it my turn?
Yeah.
You're right. My number three is Guardians of the Galaxy.
I didn't put that on here. I had to choose, and it was a heartbreaking choice. I love Guardians of the Galaxy, but I do think there are better movies. I think that's probably one of the most fun movies, but I think there's better
movies. I'm putting it there solely because I cannot think of another Marvel movie except for maybe The Avengers that I just had more balls-out fun watching.
Totally. Yeah, I'm not going to fight you on that one. It's great.
It felt like a – honestly, it felt – this came out before Force Awakens, right?
Yes, I believe.
Yeah, if it was like watching a Star Wars movie.
Yeah, totally.
It was that kind of energy. Yeah. It was a space opera.
It's the first real attempt to do cosmic, and cosmic's so fucking hard to do because who cares about most of those characters? It's great. It's funny. And I was already, I think you were too, a huge James Gunn fan, and it was so fun to watch him enter the mainstream and like – deal with all of that, and it was just great. I
remember at the announcement of this movie, I remember thinking like, wow, they're gonna do a talking raccoon. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And like, this movie ends with a talking raccoon crying over a stick.
Yeah.
And it's not played for laughs.
No,
it's totally earnest. And
I still am blown away by that shot. That does so much for that character, where you just see them right after they get showered in the prison. And you just see all these things sticking out of his back and him, like, very helpless and wet. And you feel so bad for him. And you know everything you need to know about Rocket. It's such a great, like, two-second-long scene that just works perfectly.
And this is also the epitome of a Marvel movie in that you have such affection for these really well-drawn-out heroes. And no one gives a shit about the villain.
Yep, yep. Yes, yes, yes. That is true. I mean, in this movie, I think the bonus is that it works better that the villain is a nobody, because then they just get to be idiots around him, which is more fun.
Yep.
I generally don't think Marvel movies do that as well. I would say, like, out of all the Marvel movies with a nobody villain, this is the one that probably made that as a choice the most that I could tell. But yeah. But Lee Pace is good. I like him in it.
Yeah, Lee Pace is great. This has... Yeah, I love this. I love the intro, too. The heartbreaking intro with Star-Lord and his mom, leading to the dancing in front of the
totally
the logo. Man, I love this movie.
So my number three we already talked about, but my number three is Civil War. So we can move on. What is your?
Do you have anything else you want to add about Civil War?
No, I mean, I think I said most of it during yours. It's very hard to build up enough to get the emotional impact that movie gets when you watch Tony and Cap fighting at the end. And it does it so well. Like, you feel for both of these people so much, and there's so much pain in that scene, and it's great. It's just great.
I want to say a thing we didn't touch on at all, almost as much as it is Tony. Well, there's another character who has a really interesting arc throughout this movie, and it is the Black Panther.
Oh, that's right. In this movie. Yeah.
Chadwick Boseman fucking blows it out of the park.
No, he's great.
In his introduction, and like him grappling with the need for revenge in trying to avenge his father, leading up to his final conversation with Zemo. It's just like some of the best stuff the Marvel universe has to offer.
That scene is comparable to me with one of my favorite scenes in a movie that is not on this list, because I don't think it's a perfect movie, but that scene at the end of Age of Ultron where Ultron and Vision are talking.
It's great.
It really reminds me of that as well. What's your number two?
My number two is Captain America Winter Soldier.
So I didn't put them both on the list because I felt like that would be a little bit of a cheat, because I do think that they are a continuation of the same storyline. So basically I'm calling you a cheater. But no, it was very hard for me not to include this on the list. In fact, that probably is due for a rewatch for me. I haven't seen it in quite a long time. It's a great movie.
I went back and forth between my top favorite and my second top favorite. My number one and two, because I like them both so much, and you can use the process of deduction now to figure out what they both are. But Winter Soldier is just awesome. Yeah. Like, it, again,
so why do you like it more than Civil War?
I feel like it's a more reined in story.
Totally,
I think it's a tighter story.
It's it feels like an Ed Brubaker story. That was what blew me away when I first saw it, because I'm a big Ed Brubaker fan. He came up with, for those of you not familiar, he came up with the idea of the Winter Soldier. He basically invented that character, and he wrote a Captain America run that was very much about espionage. It was very grounded, and this felt like that. It felt like a bunch of people who almost don't have superpowers trying to outsmart each other. And I like that a lot about that movie.
Ian, this movie fucking has Robert Redford saying Hail Hydra.
Oh my god,
also.
That's
like,
true.
What else?
I remember texting my dad and saying, "Hey, I just watched a movie where Robert Redford said Hail Hydra. I'm living the dream right now."
And you ruined it for your dad.
Yeah, no, he didn't. My dad doesn't give a shit. He doesn't care anymore.
Did I tell you about my experience watching this movie?
No.
So I watched this movie opening night. So I watched this movie opening night, and I was so excited. I was, like, so excited to watch this movie.
Yeah.
And there's a moment halfway through the movie where the Winter Soldier's mask gets blown off, mm-hmm. and Cap sees that it's his best friend, Bucky Barnes.
Bucky Barnes, ooh. Yeah. And you didn't see Bucky it coming
Rogers,
at all, right?
Bucky Rogers is their adopted son, because they're boyfriends. But Bucky and Cap look at each other, and then Cap says, "Bucky," and then Bucky goes, "Who the hell's Bucky?" Mm-hmm. And then the screen froze, because the buffet next to the theater caught fire, and so they evacuated the theater
and no.
sent everyone home with readmit slips, and then I caught a cold that night and couldn't go to the theater for, like, 3 months.
That's horrible. That's a nightmare.
Yeah, it was a real bummer.
I will say I remember when I first saw The Incredible Hulk, one of my favorite moments in that whole movie – and it's only because they called it a super soldier formula before they gave it to him, is when, what's his name? What's the British guy?
Tim Roth.
Thank you. When Tim Roth is fighting Hulk and he's all juiced up. And I was like, oh, this is actually what it would look like if Captain America and the Hulk fought. And I got, like, a sense of that. and because that's hard to like play out, right? Like, you have to, I don't know. It's just, there's something about that like kinetic movement and the dynamic of it all that just works really well. And then and then I got to see a whole movie of some of the best fight choreography I still have ever seen in my life. Winter Soldier has just absolutely blew me away with its fight choreography, and they continue that perfectly into Civil War as well.
Cap versus Balrog the Leaper?
That's not it. It's something like that.
Batroc.
Yeah, thank you. Batroc the Leaper.
Yeah.
Is
so
amazing.
Good.
The knife fight between Buck and Cap is amazing as well. That movie is so tight.
I love that movie. Yeah. So tight, man.
I didn't mean it. I meant, you know what I meant. Not so radical. So, like, tightly shot.
I want to revisit it one more time before we move on. Civil War reintroduces William Hurt from the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, that's right.
Which, up to that point, people had just kind of tossed aside the Incredible Hulk like it wasn't actually canon, but whatever, you know?
And I like Incredible Hulk. I mean, I understand why people are less happy with it than the others, for sure. But it's a fun movie. I think it's actually very fun. Has the weirdest cameo I've ever seen. There's like half a second with Omar in it.
The Incredible Hulk?
Yeah. When he's blowing up Harlem, you see Omar walk out of, like,
Michael K. Williams.
Yeah, Michael K. Williams walks out of, like, a bodega and then runs around and runs back in, like, while everything's blowing up in the street. It's that final fight between Abomination and Hulk. It's really weird.
I forgot to bring this up. In the X-Files episode, the Unusual Suspects,
uh-huh.
It's like a subtle crossover with Homicide: Life on the Street.
Yes, that's right. Munch is in it. I totally forgot to talk about that. It's not just Life on the Streets. It's also, that's who he plays in Law and Order, right? Doesn't he play
Law
Detective Munch on Law and Order?
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure Richard Belzer is playing the same character he plays in Law and Order and Detective or Homicide: Life on the Streets. But yeah, it's amazing.
That's awesome.
It's a really funny joke. So my number two was Spider-Man Homecoming, which we talked about extensively. I will say the one thing I want to add is I don't think anything has ever made me happy or laugh for as long as it has in a Marvel movie as the tapes that that Hannibal Buress plays for the Captain America tapes that Hannibal Buress plays in gym and in detention. His reactions to them and just the fact that they exist like makes me happy on so many levels.
I will say a thing I really love about Spider-Man Homecoming that we didn't talk about the first time mm-hmm. is that the personal stakes for Peter in a lesser movie, you know, he'd be Peter's sort of love interest in this movie is a girl named Liz, and he's constantly blowing off Liz to be Spider-Man right. throughout this movie, and he's constantly blowing off his what's his best friend's name?
I forget. Ned.
Yeah, but
Ned.
That guy. Ned.
Yeah.
He's constantly blowing off his friends yeah. to go be Spider-Man, which he doesn't need to be Spider-Man
right,
either.
Right.
And in a lesser movie, there'd be like the inevitable third act. All of his friends hate him.
Right, right.
There's a sad montage.
Yeah.
And it's just, you get what the consequence is.
Yeah,
the consequence is that Peter doesn't get to be a normal kid.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
he doesn't get the simple joy of like hanging out at the pool with his friends.
Spider-Man is probably my favorite Marvel character. It's because he's super grounded, and it's because his life is crazy, fun, funny, but also scary all the time. And my least favorite thing about any of the Spider-Man movies before this is how emo he always is.
Yeah.
And he is, like, he gets to be that, but, like, there's a really fine line you have to walk there, and they do it so well in this movie that he's so lost and on his heels the whole time that he doesn't have time to be sad. And so the stakes are real, the danger is real, the worried about being caught is real, but it doesn't feel depressing.
Right.
Yeah.
There's exactly. And I really like the Raimi movies.
I do
like,
too, but yeah, I mean, he's an emo Spider-Man in those movies. He spends a lot of time brooding.
It's not just the emo thing. It's just like so much of the conflict he has with Mary Jane before she figures out that he's Spider-Man are her just being really angry with him
yes.
for missing her show.
Yeah.
Things like that, yeah. which are understandable on a character level, but I like kind of that Spider-Man's friends and Spider-Man Homecoming have the emotional yeah. maturity to just be like, I don't, whatever,
right.
dude.
You well, know? You can make fun of me for this, but I used to watch Smallville a lot. And one of the running problems in a lot of superhero movies and TV shows, especially TV shows because it's serialized, is eventually your female lead is just going to be saying over and over, I can't trust you, I can't trust you. And we as the audience know that this character is doing what they're supposed to be doing and helping people. So you end up just unfairly hating this poor woman. And
right.
like Lana Lang is like one of the most hated characters in television for that reason. And the same thing I think happened with Mary Jane in the Spider-Man movies. Like she's not being unfair, but we feel like she is because we know more than she does. And that's an insane thing to like try to maintain, you know.
There's a wonderful moment at the very end where Liz just looks at him and goes like, "Man, I hope you figure out whatever."
Yeah, yeah, it's great.
I hope you figure out your life, Peter. Which is a really great thing for her to say. Like, she's clearly fed up with whatever he's got going on, but she's got her own life. She doesn't care, you know?
What's your number one?
My number one's Iron Man 3.
Oh, wow. Okay. Avengers is not on there for you. My number one is Avengers.
Nope. Okay, let's talk about Avengers.
Why is Avengers not on there for you? That's amazing.
Because I only had five. I really like Avengers, but I honestly, I thought Civil War was a better Avengers movie than Avengers.
That's interesting. So, I get that. I think Civil War is a more contained Avengers movie, but I agree with you.
I'm not going to shit talk Avengers.
Yeah,
I mean,
the reason Avengers is number one for me is because I fucking got to see the Avengers for the first time. Like, I'm still uh-huh. remembering, I will always remember the first time I got to see, like, Hulk like jump off of a wall into a building and then get thrown somewhere by Thor, and like all that stuff just was so fun for me.
One of the most exciting moments I've ever had in watching like any Marvel movie or any movie ever is the moment where Hulk says, "You want to know my secret?
Yeah.
I'm always
yeah,
angry." And then punching the alien and then immediately doing that famous 360 shot where the only recognizable music from any of the MCU movies, because they all have terrible music,
yeah.
That theme plays while it circles around all of them.
Also,
so
Loki
good.
Is a good villain. Like that.
Loki's a great villain.
That old man who tells him that there will always, when he says there's never been a man like me, and the guy says there will always be men like you, that's a great line. That whole scene, mm-hmm. the fact that they set that scene up in Germany is fantastic. Like everything about that movie, I mean, Joss Whedon is Joss Whedon for a reason. Like he wrote a good movie there.
He did.
Yeah. Do you want to say more about Iron Man 3?
No. Well, okay, I will say, I was gonna, because I was, as we were hitting duplicates, I was like, all right, I'm gonna table something to talk about in a couple minutes. Iron Man 3, I feel like I'm also a little bit reactionary with me putting Iron Man 3 up there. I think Iron Man 3 is easily in my top 5 of MCU movies. Uh-huh. Iron Man 3 endured a rash of shit, and,
What do you mean? I'm actually not familiar with what you're referring to, I don't think.
Oh, Iron Man 3 is, like, a much, like, it's very, it's maligned.
Oh,
by,
is it?
Like, the nerd community.
Oh, well,
totally.
They can go fuck themselves. That's stupid. That's yeah, a great, exactly. It's a great movie. Like, and what, like for what reason?
It's The Last Jedi before Last Jedi. I think a lot of it had to deal with the Mandarin twist. But,
Okay.
I love Iron Man 3. Yeah. I think it's, like,
yeah. There's no, movie. Guess what, guys? We don't need an evil Middle Eastern or Asian warlord in our world right now. Like, that's not necessary. It's not going to look good if it happens. Like, it was a great, way to do it. It was very intelligently put together. I think it said some interesting things about the culture we live in. It was great.
I don't want to end on that, though. So I want to end on the Avengers.
Okay.
It's a better note to end on. Whereas, like, Thor, it took a couple movies to figure Thor out.
Uh-huh.
I think the Avengers,
which, by the way, I disagree with. I think the first Thor is a great movie. I know we've talked about that before, but
the first Thor is a fine movie.
You're crazy.
It's okay.
It's great.
It's, I mean, it's like, it's not the best. It's okay. It's, it's like
neither of us put Ragnarok on there. That's a little surprising for me. I struggled with that one. I basically I decided I was either gonna let myself do Spider-Man or Ragnarok, and I just like Spider-Man way more.
I love Ragnarok. I have complicated feelings.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot you did.
No, and Ragnarok's great. It's just, it feels like two movies, and I like one movie better than the other one. But Thor, this was the first movie that got to bounce Thor off of other characters and make him the comedic relief.
Yes, totally. Totally, yeah.
And this is right around, I think, where we figured out Chris Hemsworth is way better as a comedic actor.
Yeah, he's fucking funny. He's really great at that.
And that's why he's always, like, the treat of the Avengers movies.
Yeah,
cause
that's, I think what I miss most about that's, I think Thor and Hulk are the reasons why I hesitate to call those, Civil War and Winter Soldier Avengers movies. Because you don't have these big, just terrifying, like, beasts in there. I mean, they're really good and they feel like Avengers movies, but I always miss those guys when they don't show up.
Did you, Taika Waititi did a short about Thor and Hulk during Civil War.
It's great.
Did you watch it?
Yeah,
it's really good.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. Check it out if you haven't seen that. I think that went well. I was curious to see how that would go.
We
but...
need to get back to like an hour.
Yeah, I know. We're at like almost, we're going to be at close to 2 hours, I think. Anyway, what are you doing next week, Bobby? Or next time?
I am dragging us back to the wonderful world of podcasting.
Okay.
I am assigning you a podcast called Our Debut Album.
Okay.
It is hosted by Graham Clark and Dave Shumka, who are Vancouver area comedians. They are also the hosts of a popular podcast called Stop Podcasting Yourself.
Okay, I know
which
that one.
I have not listened to it.
I haven't either,
you?
But I've heard of it.
Our Debut Album is the two of them. They decide to write an album. Neither of them has any songwriting experience, and so each episode,
that's amazing,
they give themselves an hour to write a hit song.
Okay, you sold me. I'm already on board. I'm 100% not kidding. That sounds amazing.
They don't want to do a jokey novelty album.
Right.
They want it to be somewhat earnest and serious.
Okay.
And I'm going to assign you the fourth episode called Sharon Shockwave.
Okay. Great. So, I'm on board. My pick for next time is a TV show that I'm really surprised you still haven't seen, because you're a big fan of Fargo, which has the same showrunner. How do you say his name? What is his? It's
Noah Hawley.
I didn't know if it's Howley or Hawley.
Hawley.
Yeah.
Hawley.
But it's Legion on FX, which is technically a superhero show, but I think when you see it, you'll realize it's very, very, very distinct from traditional superhero stuff in a lot of ways. The one thing you need to know before you start is they're doing a slightly different thing than they do with the character in the comics, but this is told from the point of view of the main character, who is mentally unwell. So it is definitely a unreliable narrator situation, and it's a great show. So I'm giving you the pilot episode.
Cool. It's going to force me to finally watch that
show. Yeah, it's a great show, and the second season's coming out soon. It's one of the best things I've ever seen Aubrey Plaza do. I'm going to tell you this on the show before you watch it. One of my favorite pieces of trivia about that show is the character that Aubrey Plaza plays was originally written for like a 50 or 60-year-old heavyweight man. And she loved the script so much that she came in and asked if she could read for that part. And they were like, oh, you don't have to read for it. You're Aubrey Plaza. We'll just give it to you. Just let us rewrite the script for you. And she was like, no, I want the script. I want every line to stay exactly the same. So she's gay, but she doesn't ever say, like, I'm gay. She just is super lecherous and pervy about women because she's supposed to be this. Like she just talks like a 50 or 60-year-old fat dude. Like, it's really, really, it's really interesting. It works super well.
Cool.
Yeah. So, anyway. So, yeah, that was the show for this
week. All right,
man. What did we learn, Bobby?
I don't know.
That the Marvel movies are great. That's what we learned.
They're great.
There actually are more good villains than I remembered now that we started talking about it a little bit. Not a lot, but there's more than I remembered.
You know what we should argue about once we run out of things to argue about? We should argue about the top five best post-credits stingers
from
Marvel movies.
That's really scraping the bottom of the barrel. But that would be, yeah.
Because it's clear that Guardians of the Galaxy would be the top one, right?
Did you see in the new Super Bowl spot for Infinity War that when the Guardians show up in that trailer, Teenage Groot is in the background sulking with his phone in his face?
No.
That's maybe my favorite thing that's happened recently. There's a static shot of all five of them through a porthole, and he's like slouching back in his chair with his phone up against his face.
Is that a feature of Groot in the comics?
No, not even remotely. It's just like a really fun thing.
That's great.
Yeah, totally. All right, man. Well, that was fun.
That was a lot of fun.
All right, we'll see you guys next time.
Bye.
Bye. You're